So one of the really critical explorations with meditation and the human journey in general is to narrow down the gap and ultimately realize the dissolution of the gap between what we call means and what we call ends. So, in our view at times of life, which is very connected to time, to direction, to sometimes purpose, to journey, to future, these views and notions. In those views and notions, there's this fairly pervasive and even insidious fixation upon means leading to ends. And what the meditative possibility awakens is that, not just in a conceptual sense, but in actual experiential sense, that the means are the end. And another way to word this would be that we have an opportunity to see that our actions, what we perceive to be our doings, are actually the ongoing, continuous expression of our being. And that there's no separation between being and doing. Just as there's actually ultimately no separation between means and end. Now, another way to get at this would be that as the meditation deepens, as it truly deepens, as it truly opens, because that's what meditation is, it's this unending opening that includes all experience. So it's not like certain experiences are opening and other experiences aren't. All experiences are opening. That what we perceive to be result and end and product and destination, these things actually, sometimes quite powerfully and sometimes just very subtly, dissolve. Now, does that mean we have no goals? Well, no. I mean, I was talking to a person today and he's remodeling his kitchen and he's very excited about his countertop. And he's describing it in detail, and I'm going to have a new counter, and it's going to be like this. It's going to be beautiful, he says. And so there's a goal, there's a practical goal related to the modeling of his kitchen. Now, there's no contradiction, ultimately, between that exploration and investment and good feelings and creative, process, because he's doing it himself, so that's part of what makes him feel good, is, he's doing the work himself. He's a good carpenter, knows what he's doing. There's no contradiction between that and discovering that your ideas about where the meditation is taking you, where the meditation's going, what the meditation is for, are just ideas. And that meanwhile, underneath this idea machine, which is partly what the brain in all of its magnificence is doing, is producing ideas, apparently, out of nothing, or out of just the vastness of things. Thoughts appear inside this brain. By the way, neuroscience has found that as all this movement is happening, all this activity in these brains, that there's actually no designated center to it. They're actually discovering scientifically that there is no I. There's no center, they're coming to their own kind of awakenings that there is no self. As we thought there was, like, there's a governor in here governing all this. No, it's a process in a way that's governing itself. And this is going to become more and more and more explicated, more and more explained, more and more, you could say, documented. And we'll see what the brain or what our perception as race of humans does with that. Because if you think about that, 2,500 years ago, there wasn't any of that kind of research being done. It was all direct phenomenological exploration, all experiential. It was just human beings going into the nature of things, going into the truth, coming to their own realizations, and then relating from that. You know, they didn't need to prove anything. You know, they didn't need to go through the paradigm of a conceptual mind to understand these things and then kind of lay that back into experience, because that's hopefully what will happen. You see, if the awakened nature of what the human being actually is going to more fully express itself, I mean really fully express itself in this world collectively, then it's going to have to come about through different means. It's not going to just be through people contemplating, because some people are fundamentally resistant to that. They're fundamentally resistant to sitting down and reading about the Dharma. Their belief systems, their ideas about the truth won't be penetrated. They won't even see, they won't even be interested, they won't even read about it. They won't even talk to anybody who has an experience of it. But if some data that's within their frame of reference comes along and they go, holy smokes, look what's in the New York Times, honey. I mean, it could be to honey or just to themselves, right? Whoa, look what's in the New York Times. I've stopped drinking my coffee. Look at that. Whoa. So it'd be very interesting to see, you know, how that unfolds. But I'm getting off the point a little bit there. So I want to again stay as often as I can when talking about the meditation and the meditative possibilities, very, very practical, so that hopefully these talks don't just, you know, stir ideas, but that they point at what we can know directly experientially. So let's take another very, very central and core example in terms of a meditative experience or meditative object, the very nature of the breathing. The breath is the mind as much as it's the body. The quality of the mind, quietude or lack thereof of the mind, is in the breath. It is the breath. As much as the physiology of the body, the organ systems of the body, all of this functioning sensation field of the body is expressing itself intimately and as the breathing. State of the body, state of the mind is in every single breath. So when there's attentiveness to this breathing, not only is it possible, if we really allow it to do its job, allow it to do its medicine, that the mental life settles. And if this mental life doesn't settle, and I mean significantly settle, we will not see the expansive nature of our being. The expansive nature of our being will be contracted into the preoccupation with thinking, planning, remembering. And you know better than anybody in this room how much mental activity occurred in the last 60 minutes when we were sitting, and how much diminishment of that. Now, I'm not saying that should happen. I'm saying it can. And that is why, in part, throughout all of the you might say expressions or lineages or stylizations, yeah, of the Buddhist teachings, at least as expressed in meditation, the breath is there. It doesn't matter whether you come through Zen, Tibetan meditation traditions, the early Theravada schools, any of those, they all are utilizing this. And there's a really, really sound, pragmatic, real, and valid reason. And you know what it is? Because it works. Because it works. That doesn't mean you can't mix things in around that, like, for example, counting of the breath. Some people like to, you know, have been taught to whisper in and out, just to help link the attentiveness to the breathing more and more consistently. So I talk to people sometimes online, sometimes on the phone, sometimes face to face, and I find a lot of people do meditate regularly, but they do not know what they're doing. Their meditation and the actual nature of their meditation, and even how to do the meditation, because again, this how to do thing, again, means an end. This how to do thing is about opening into the nature of being through, you might say, the idea that you're doing something. Like the idea that I am paying attention to the breathing. That's an idea. So I am going to do that kind of meditation. That's an idea. And if that points effectively, if one has that idea, that it's a good idea to focus on the breathing while sitting, then the purpose of that idea, the pointer of that idea, the function of that idea is to link the attentiveness to the breath in such a way that that idea isn't necessary. The experience of what is actually happening begins to, you might say, take over. So it's a filling up in a way, even if you're watching the breath up in here, it's a filling up of this energetic sense of being embodied. So I now, quote unquote, not that there is an I, but the idea that there's an I become embodied within something other than an idea. Okay? So that that's why they talk about the breath as really a whole body phenomena, even though it's centered largely in here, as it releases. And sometimes we have this at times spontaneously when we're doing, say, a relaxation, like a shavasana at the end of yoga, and people feel the natural breath, and it feels like this wave. And all of a sudden, it's like as big as the ocean. And then, once again, it seems to be constricted, you know, and confined to the body in a more familiar sense. So there's different ways that the expansive nature of being opens up. And what I'm pointing at is one of the ways is through a connectedness to breathing. And as that breath experience begins to, you might say, show itself, free itself, there's not a need to be thinking about things. There's not a need to be figuring things out. The planning mind, the remembering tendency, the imaginative process, as interesting and wonderful as it is in its own way, becomes less and less central, and in fact, at times, completely goes away. And when it completely goes away, this whole space, this mental space, completely and utterly lets go. And then the expansiveness of mind, in a particular sense, I'm not saying the true nature of mind, but the expansiveness of mind, becomes an actual direct insight. And so this is something that, in a way, we can cultivate. So I'm talking about it in a very practical sense. Now, you might get lucky, you know, like Doug comes here sometimes, Doug Loeb. He said, well, for me, insight's kind of just like this hit or miss thing. It's kind of like luck. If I get an insight, it's just like, oh, I got lucky. And then the rest of the time, I'm just kind of, oh, whoa, I got lucky. It's like the lotto, you know. Whoa, numbers. And it's like, no, Doug. It doesn't have to be like that. It doesn't have to just be luck. Ultimately, you're not controlling this, yes. But it doesn't have to be as random and as sort of luck-centered as winning the lotto. Because if that's the case, then there is no cultivation of insight. There is nothing you can do. Now, ultimately, there isn't. But relatively, there is. Why did the Buddha say, I achieved, or I attained, or I realized, whatever word he used, nothing? And you can take that and pull it apart and say, no thing. Because liberation, freedom, is not a thing. That's what he's pointing at. It's not an attainment. It's not something you get. So if you think about that for a second, what that means then is that the means to an end, right, that whole map, that whole construction, that whole shebang, is nothing. That it doesn't pertain. It is not like fixing the kitchen. Because again, if it was fixing the kitchen, and even if you didn't know how, which I don't know how, I don't know how to do a counter, I wouldn't even, well, I might. No, I probably wouldn't. I'm going to get somebody who knows how. Even if I don't know how and I read the books, it's still not the same. And if it was, then all of us could just sit down, talk to somebody who knows how to do a counter, read the book, bing. And the human existence, the human journey, would be fulfilled like that. And anybody with enough time and energy and attention who isn't preoccupied with physiological needs or survival, getting food and shelter all the time, which a lot of people are, more people than not, are busy right now doing that. That's what's got their attention. There is no mindfulness of the breathing, or very little. It's survival. It's what am I going to eat? How am I going to feed my children? Where am I going to be tonight? Am I going to be okay? I think for me at least, that's extremely relevant to point out, and it can't really be pointed out too often. Otherwise, we can really get myopic, really lose track of our human family, lose track of our place in it, and lose track of the absolute privilege, I mean absolute privilege, to have the time, the space, the money, the energy, the health, the house, the friends, to sit and look at these things. So, a couple more things. Three words. Loosening, tightening, and balancing. Okay, let's look at this for a minute. Loosening, tightening, and balancing. For some of us, as we're meditating, we're actually too loose. What do I mean by that? Okay, sit down and let's say, you know, this is freedom right here that would say, you know, you can do whatever you want. You could sit there with your eyes closed and draw pictures in your mind. You know, make up a garden plot. Think about how you're going to paint your new kitchen when you get it. Plan your breakfast. Remember something from a book. I mean, just... You could sit, and if that's not going on, parts of this thing are hurting. And your attention's being drawn to this, and the shoulder's this, and the neck's that, and the back is that, and the knee is this. And you can spend a lot of time, like, noticing that, and then even struggling with that. Trying to figure out how to not react to what the body's doing. Okay? Or you might not do those things just because they're not predominant and there's this understanding or this appreciation or this gratitude even. There's this attentive, mindful care, kind presence and the breathing unfolding. And you're going to have a very, very different meditation depending on, in a way, what you're giving attention to, what you're feeding. And whether we know it or not, we're feeding something almost all the time. We're feeding our own unique stream of karma. We're feeding our own unique stream of cause and effect. And we're living in those loops of causation. And that's fine in a way. There's nothing wrong with that, but it's limited. It's not all there is to this show. Even the breath attentiveness, you know, the rhythm of the breath. One feels the in-breath, one feels the out-breath. One feels that the in-breath is, in fact, a cause for the out-breath, because without the in-breath, there is no out-breath. And that the in-breath and the out-breath, when attended to, actually become a cause for this settling. Huh, look at that. There's an insight. Whoa, and the body relaxed. And the mind stopped being so, you might say, even just subtly irritated or reactive to what's happening in the physical body. Huh, look at that. It starts to be clear that this really is something that can be directly experienced. And yet, we could put a little measurement, little gauge on some people's experience. It's just kind of like something that would read. Is this meditative process too tight or too loose. Some of us would be too loose, which means, you know, we really don't care that much that the mind is wandering. We just kind of, next thing you know, the head's going like this, and the next thing you know, we really don't care that we know that we're not getting enough rest. And we know that when we go to sit down and meditate, our meditation is floppy, kind of loose. Not right away. After a while, pretty soon we're passing out. Maybe we see it as a regular pattern. 40 minutes in, 50 minutes in, we pass out. Or it takes a half an hour, and all of a sudden, I'm angry. Well, look at that. I'm annoyed. Look at that. I don't know why, I just am. 30 minutes in, 20 minutes in, 50 minutes in, 1 day in, 1 year in, whatever. I'm wondering, what am I doing this for? I don't know. All of a sudden, I'm like, lost? That's all very interesting to just see. Sometimes disturbing. You really don't have it figured out. You really don't know what you're doing sometimes. And it can be very profound. Even shocking. I don't know who I am. I don't know what I'm doing. And none of my beliefs and ideas that I've been carrying around have really any relevance right now in this moment. I am bewildered, perplexed. And I might be disturbed by that, and I might just be like, whoa, whoa. Those are all just beliefs, Paul. Those are all just ideas. Those are all just conditioned views that you've been carrying around about things. But at any rate, talking about too loose, sometimes there is lack of appropriate discipline. And so the meditation is extremely limited because the mind is just not tamed. And I'm talking about the thinking mind particularly. That energy is just perpetually wandering. So that'd be too loose. What to do? It's really simple. Stick with the theme of the evening. Notice when, be interested to notice when the mind first leaves the breath, if you're using the breath. Notice when the mind first leaves the breath, when it first leaves the breath. Not 2 seconds, 3 seconds, 4 seconds, 5 seconds, 1 minute, 30 seconds, or whatever, after it's left the breath. Notice, be interested to notice when it first leaves. Catch it. And with love and care and kindness and the privilege of freedom as the means. The privilege of freedom as the means. Just link it back to the breath. Right there. Just like a feather. Just come back. Simple. But if you actually penetrate those words, what does that actually mean to do that? That's no small thing. That's about as profound and deep as it is to observe the breathing and be completely non-interfering with its flow. Because when there is complete non-interference with the flow of breath and there is clarity in the freedom of breath, there is no I or self. Bang. It could be just for a second. Be longer, there's the illumination of the realization that there is no I or self running the show. Boom. Just breath. Let's go to the other side. Sometimes the sitting's unfolding and there's too much trying. Too much efforting. So the attention lifts off the breathing, starts to float, and there's comes up. You ever been, or it could be, just a little, it's too tight, too much effort. You could say the too loose is too little effort, too tight, too much effort. It's not the right kind of effort. It's striving, it's straining, it's trying to get somewhere. It doesn't see, that doesn't see, that energy, that quality doesn't see. The means are the end. It's too invested in the means are working towards the end. And it's so logical because, let's go back to the kitchen counter for a minute. If you're fixated on the end result of the kitchen counter, not only is it possible that when the nails are going in, the hammer goes on your thumb because you're not really focused where you need to be, but you're missing the enjoyment of the creation of the counter. You're busy looking for the end. And I'm talking in this in a very, very subtle way because it doesn't have to be so extreme. I'm talking about a very subtle way that the mind is programmed and invested in results. And how those results are projected, magical, fanciful, wishful thinking. That's it. I don't care how clear the thought is, because thinking about realization is never realization. Never. So you get to, you can get more and more clear about what realization actually is. What this no-thing, empty fullness of being is. Little glimpses come through. How do they come through? The breath's unfolding. Maybe there's some thinking moving around. Meditation not too tight, not too loose. Some sense of balance, some sense of equanimity, some sense of equipoise, some sense of quietude, enough, quote-unquote, of those things in some synergistic, magical, beautiful, alchemical harmony. And there's what in the Zen they call frog jumps off the lily pad, plop. You're that. You're not seeing a movie and imagining a frog jumping off a lily pad into the water and what a nice sound plop is. You're that. You're the lily pad, you're the fog, you're the sound, the water. And it's complete. And that's a taste. It's a taste of fulfillment. So I was beginning to talk last week, just a little bit, just pointing at it, about the possibility of fulfilling your human existence. And what is that about? What does that mean to be engaged in the means as the end, such that life becomes clearly for us, for those who have the opportunity and the privilege of that possibility in life, to fulfill your human existence before the last breath of the body. And that can become an imperative, that can become a spiritual urgency that has balance, not too tight, not too loose within it. And it doesn't exclude any of the activities, the remodeling of the kitchen, the decisions that we have to make to live. The so-called good ones and the so-called not so good ones, the so-called mistakes, that was a bad decision, I made a mistake, all of it. Is part of the fulfillment of the human existence, the human journey. In the relative scope of the conditioned mind, you are guaranteed to mess up. And you're guaranteed to get it right in your own definition of what is right. You're going to get a mix of grades. You're not going to get all A's. You're not going to get all F's. You're going to get a mix of grades. Given by others at times, or given by yourself at times, of your own performance. And meanwhile, it does seemingly make sense to have a base, what I call the one seat, the base, or what not I call, but a lot of people call it, I just dovetail with this, the one seat, the base of, you could say, a practice, like meditation. Doesn't have to be meditation as we talk about it here, but something that centers this wild nature at times, this chaotic, unwieldy, desirous, fearful, agitated, restless, confused, deluded, sleepy, bored, depressed, body-mind process. Because we don't take responsibility, especially as we age, and the inevitable vulnerability of the closer and closer, you know, you could say host or hostess, if you like, of dying. The host or hostess of dying comes. And there's no escape that. And you cut yourself, and the cut takes twice as long as it used to take to heal. Or you bruise yourself, and the bruise takes twice as long. And in some cases, I notice with some of the older folks, you know, 70, 80 or more years old, the bruises, they just don't go away. It's big enough, strong enough, it just stays there, just morphs around. It's all in the nature. You know, in a true, real sense, there's nothing right or wrong, it just is what it is. But how, within that, you could say, degenerating condition of the body-mind process, do we take full advantage of the opportunity to fulfill our human existence before the last breath? And that's what the meditation, the gift of the meditation, can offer. So let me stop there.